the content in Orangepill app are other Bitcoiners. We want you to go in, either find a Bitcoin event that you're going to go to in real life, or find another in real life Bitcoiner that's in your neighborhood.
Treasury companies, stable coins, Bitcoin lending, like it's a lot of like TradFi interwoven products being marketed. My concern that I have is, are fewer people buying spot Bitcoin? And maybe that's part of the price action too. And more people are buying Strategy.
You show somebody that you just transferred Bitcoin to them permissionlessly and instantly and for nearly a zero fee. That's the best way to Orangepill somebody.
We have lots of folks in Australia, Canada, the UK, who are, you know, looking at the headlines, what's coming down the pipeline for them.
That's what we're solving for the future, is like, I think we can make everybody's life better by connecting them with other people in real life.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Brian DeMint. Brian is, first of all, a fantastic guy, but he is head of marketing at the Orangepill app. He also has written several excellent books. We talk about the state of Bitcoin adoption. We talk about building the social layer of Bitcoin, everything he's working on. We even get to some of his side projects, his other ventures, including health and wellness. So I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Brian here with me. Brian, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Michael, thanks for having me, brother. It's good to see you again. And we met before in person, but yeah, this is our first time online.
Yeah, it was our first real sit down. So I'm excited to chat. So I think this is a question that we're going to start with that everyone has, because you see everyone talking about it online. You hear people getting frustrated, burnt out. What, you wrote the book on Bitcoin evangelism, called Bitcoin Evangelism. How would you explain sort of the way you frame that book and how you think about going to Orangepill friends and family?
Yeah, that's actually the genesis of the book was rooted in that. Once you go through a few bear and bull cycles, you go through enough bull cycles, you have the friends coming out of the woodwork. I think that was one of the things that's been different about this upcycle, is most people are saying, yeah, I don't even think we're in that mania phase, because I'm not getting texts or random Facebook DMs from the guy that I went to high school with 20 years ago or 10 years ago, or my college roommate. You know, a lot of people aren't getting those people coming out of the woodwork. That's, I think, when you can kind of recognize when you're getting close to peak cycle, is when that's happening. So I don't know any Bitcoiners that's happened to, or at least in mass. So I don't think we are, that's just my cycle indicator. But I wrote the book initially because in the 2017 bull market, I was getting texts that were the same questions over and over. It was maybe three or four different questions, but it was like people had this subset of questions. And they wanted you to explain Bitcoin via text message. And like, how do you explain Bitcoin by text message? And then you don't have time to go and sit down and grab coffee with each one of these people. So I sat down, I thought, you know what, I'm going to write a 5-page PDF that's just like frequently asked questions that I'm getting. And anytime somebody texts me, I'm just going to, hey, what's your email? I'll send you the PDF. That 5-page PDF turned into 10 pages, turned into 15 pages. And then I just kept going. I'm like, I'm going to see if I can write a book, because I want to kind of really encapsulate all the different questions that somebody might have. And that's a lot of the feedback I've gotten. Side note with Bitcoin evangelism is, when people read it, I get people to read it and they say, oh, I had a question and I was about to email you, but then I read the next chapter and you answered the question. And so I really tried to write it in a peel the onion way. And I think that that's how we most effectively evangelize Bitcoin to our friends and family. I was somewhat effective. I think I was actually fairly effective. I don't have anybody in my immediate circle anymore, whether it's friends, family, anybody that I'm like pretty close to at my church. All of them are Bitcoiners now. And I think that's why I felt the conviction to write the book was, these were effective strategies I used. And it was, I'll tell you, strategy number one is answer somebody's questions according to the person that they are. So if somebody tells you to explain Bitcoin to me, I'm always going to ask them a question first. If I don't know them already, if I know I'm talking to my stepfather and he's a gold bug, or my father-in-law, who's also a gold bug, I'm going to talk about scarcity. I'm going to talk about the finite nature of Bitcoin because that appeals to them. I'm not going to talk about censorship resistance. I'm not going to talk about how the mining process works. I'm not going to talk about consensus or any of that kind of stuff or trustlessness. I'm not going to talk about any of that stuff because all it's going to do is confuse them. And as soon as they feel like they're starting to drift away on their understanding, then they're going to be lost and they're going to want to push it off to another day or not revisit that conversation. So I want them to walk away from that conversation with a win. Whether they fully understand Bitcoin or not, I want them to think that I just sat down, had a Bitcoin conversation, and I absolutely know something about Bitcoin. So if all they walk away with is there's only 21 million Bitcoin, and what's the problem with fiat money? We don't know how much there is, or we don't know how much there's going to be tomorrow. We compare that to Bitcoin, where there's only going to be 21 million. That's a really easy thing for somebody to wrap their head around. Gold bugs, that's a really good evangelical point to them. Now, if you're dealing with your grandma, you go one generation up and she says, well, I just could never trust my money to an algorithm. Or I can never, they wouldn't say algorithm, but they would say, I can never trust my money to a computer, right? That's kind of, well, you could answer that kind of with an axiom. I would say, grandma, every time you drive around town, when you drive through an intersection, you go 35, 40 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour through an intersection, and you don't think twice, but you're trusting your life, something far more important than your money, to a computer or to an algorithm. And what's happening is when you go through an intersection, you're going northbound, north and southbound have a green light. That means east and westbound have a red light. That's an algorithm, grandma. That same thing that's protecting you when you're driving is actually the same kind of simplistic way the computer works when you're storing your money in Bitcoin. And then all of a sudden they start to grasp this idea of trustlessness, the fact that we don't need to trust, we can verify. And so it's all about trying to give somebody a simple way for them to walk away as though they won in that conversation. Not that they beat you in a debate, but that they won intellectually walking away from that conversation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and probably something I haven't been exceptionally patient to recognize in certain situations. I think in my life, I don't have like any gold bugs. I don't have any people who've studied Austrian economics deeply. And so it feels like this, like you have to kind of start from the beginning, and very quickly, if you're not careful, you get to the dollar's not going to last forever, and Bitcoin's we're going to hyper Bitcoinize, and everything's going to be Bitcoin. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'd be curious. So I think everyone has heard of Bitcoin at some point in time. And most people view it as like most non-Bitcoiners view it strictly as like an investment. It might be something I dip my toes in, diversify my portfolio, kind of like how you would do precious metals or, you know, emerging market equities or something like that. So I have this tendency to try ensuring that I'm reframing Bitcoin as money, because that's what I believe it to be, not an investment vehicle. It's a savings technology. It's a form of money. Is that something that you try to do? Do you try to sort of show people like skate to where the puck is going a decade from now, 3 decades from now? Or do you kind of avoid that aspect of the conversation until you touch on other points?
Now, this is something I actually learned in teaching jiu-jitsu. So I know we talked offline a little bit about, you know, my jiu-jitsu school, and you know, I'm a black belt in jiu-jitsu. I own a school where we teach. And so just last night I was teaching, you know, a class of kids and a class of adults. One of the things I like to do, and not all jiu-jitsu instructors do this, but I actually teach almost a bad version of the technique first, so that the person can understand the position. So if I'm trying to teach somebody how to manipulate somebody's arm and turn it behind their back, I don't teach them all of the details about how to do it perfectly. I actually don't even teach them the details of how to do it if somebody's resisting. That's where people walk into the class, and if they got a big ego, they're like, oh, well, this wouldn't work on me if I'm resisting. I guarantee I could do it to you even if you were resisting. That's fine. But yes, somebody on their first day, I'm not trying to teach them how to do it against a resisting opponent. I'm trying to teach them the basic elements that are going to lead them to truth down the road. So I find that I used to try and make sure I was educating somebody on every point about Bitcoin. As soon as they would say, well, my dollars, my money, I would try to correct them that, well, what your dollars are, that's currency. That's not money. Bitcoin is money. And then I would talk about what money is. And it's just like, It's them. It's me trying to teach the black belt level version of a technique to a white belt. I need to teach a white belt version of a technique to a white belt so that he can get the reps and get the understanding so that he can leave class feeling like, okay, I think I get this a little bit. And so I actually am okay with a little bit of misinformation about Bitcoin and not reframing it perfectly to somebody that doesn't understand it. Now, if I have an MBA friend or somebody who really understands finance and they're new to Bitcoin, that's an entirely different thing. You can go a few levels deep with that person, but I'm not opposed to teaching or explaining something imperfectly. Like leave the analogy for them to simmer on it so that they, again, they're getting closer to. The point isn't to get them to become a Bitcoiner right then. The point's to get them one step closer to being a Bitcoiner. And so what do you need to do to get them one step closer to Bitcoiner? Because if you get them one step closer to Bitcoiner, that means that you're going to have another conversation with them. If we burn that bridge, then we might not ever get that chance to move them closer. So I'm all about playing the long game. I'm fine with them not fully understanding it the first time. It feels icky because it's like, man, I should have said this, this, and this. I should have added these other points. They don't even know. If you tried to explain those other points, more often than not, they're not even going to understand what you're saying. And so I'm somebody that wants to over-explain, and I have to. In those conversations, I force myself to under-explain. The best thing that could happen is you under-explain something and then they ask another question. As soon as they stop asking questions, it means that you've over-explained and you've gone too far. So let the throttle of whether you should explain more or less be if the person asks you another question. So leave a little bit of that carrot dangled for them to hopefully ask a little bit more.
Yeah, it's hard to argue with the logic behind all of this. So what else in terms of practical techniques or areas that you might focus on? Are there things you hit on in the book that would be worth sharing? I think people like an action point, like, okay, this is like a protocol I can take away, you know, and go use when I'm talking and having these discussions.
Yeah, the last section of the book is called short answers to common questions. And there's one more chapter, short questions to uncommon questions. So like the uncommon questions ones is like, if you have religious friends who think that Bitcoin's like the one world currency of revelation, right? Like that's the uncommon question. So we even have answers to things like that in the book. And then there's the more common questions, like how do I know that Bitcoin isn't going to be MySpace and XRP is going to be the Facebook that disrupts it or whatever, those types of things. So I do think as a Bitcoiner, we have to have a bit of a breadth of understanding. And so as an actionable plan, I think it is important that we listen to Bitcoin content. We read Bitcoin books. But as far as an actionable plan, I would say if you want to orange pill somebody in one conversation, there's probably nothing. This is going to undersell my books. This is going to make it so you don't need my books. You don't need to listen to Michael Jordan's podcast, and it's going to put us all out of business. But honestly, the simplest thing you can do, have them download a custodial wallet because they don't have to do any kind of setup, and then just zap them 1,000 sats. Like game over. You show somebody that you just transferred Bitcoin to them permissionlessly and instantly and for nearly a zero fee. That's the best way to orange pill somebody. When my mom, who's a baby boomer, when she became an internet adopter, she would have never defined herself as somebody who was into the internet. She just had a bunco night that somebody said, hey, if you want to come to the bunco night, I need your email so I can send you an RSVP thing. And then she RSVP'd via email. And guess what? All of a sudden, my mom's an internet user. It's the same thing. If we want to orange pill the masses, we need to find practical ways to get them just to use the technology. And then it's almost like a drug dealer giving them, you know, giving you drugs for free the first time. It's like you got to try it. Now, you know, to participate, you gotta kind of, you know, get in a little bit deeper. What a terrible analogy. But it's true that people like the free sample, and the most powerful thing you can do by sending somebody a zap is not just that they saw Bitcoin work and now they've used it. Guess what? Now they have 1,000 sats to their name and they're no longer an other. Before the conversation, it's Michael's a Bitcoiner. I'm not a Bitcoiner. We are different. Now like it or not, you have Bitcoin, you're a Bitcoiner, you're one of us. And most people, they just want to be invited to the party. Like they tell you how dumb the party is from the outside. And they say, oh, I don't want to go to your party. Oh, dude, I don't want to go out late on a Saturday night. I don't want to be tired, you know, church on Sunday or whatever. I don't want to stay out late. But then as soon as you invite them to the party, like, I'm going to be there right away. So many people want to come to the party. That's why they're even talking about Bitcoin in the first place, but they just want to feel smart, like they had an objection. So as a protocol, as an order of doing things, do whatever you can to make that person feel invited into Bitcoin and to feel like a genius when they left the conversation. If you feel that it's an oppositional conversation at all, if you feel like it's a debate, your side versus theirs, you are losing. We only spread the network effect of Bitcoin if we welcome people in. Now, that's why I call the book Bitcoin Evangelism, because the most effective movement in history is the church, is Christianity. And how did Christianity spread to every corner of the world? Well, they had two really buttoned up answers for two different types of people. There was the atheist. There was the person who didn't believe in any kind of God. And so how did Christians, evangelical Christians, how did they witness to people who didn't believe in any kind of God? And then how did they witness to the pagan, somebody that believed in a higher power, but they believed in all sorts of other gods and stuff like that. And so evangelical Christians evangelized Christianity in a way that could answer, have a buttoned up answer for those two types of people that welcomed them in. They weren't oppositional to those two types of groups. They actually welcomed them in. And so I would say in Bitcoin, we have two very similar types of people. We have the digital money atheist, somebody that says that money's only physical, that money should only be government currency or whatever. They're a total non-believer in digital money. And then we have the altcoin pagans, the people that believe in digital money, but they believe in XRP, they believe in small cap coins, they believe in meme coins, they believe in just screwing around with yield farming and all this kind of stuff. And so how do we, if Bitcoin's going to win, and if Bitcoin's going to spread to every end of the world, every edge of the world as money, we need to find ways not to try and win and debate against those people. We need to find ways to invite those people in. And again, the easiest way to do it is to exchange money with them, buy something from them in Bitcoin, send them 1,000 sats just for free in a zap. Try to find a way to bring them into the fold that makes them feel like they won, that you weren't in opposition with them, that makes them feel like they won. So that's just the most effective way to evangelize is to, yes, make your points, but make the points in a way that you make the person feel like they came to that conclusion on their own.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So it's funny enough, I was in no way orange-pilled by Andreas Antonopoulos, who I think most people were touched by in some capacity. But I've been trying to pull together some resources, found some old videos of him that I've been watching, and they are fantastic. I completely understand the hype. But one of the things he does, like all these live presentations back in, I don't even know, 2013, 2015, is he asks everyone, you know, how many of you have a wallet on your phone? How many of you don't? Find someone who has a wallet, have them send you some Bitcoin. And like he immediately engages them before he, you know, he begins his talk on what Bitcoin is to begin with. And that's probably something I have not done very effectively is just, hey, let me send you some money. I think my reluctance has been in an age of Venmo, it's easy for people to not fully appreciate what they're witnessing when I exchange that value, you know, like, it's like, oh yeah, like this is like Venmo. You can send me money. Like you can send me money on Venmo. Sure. It's like, well, you don't understand all the intricacies and the underlying mechanisms by which Venmo works versus Bitcoin. And it's a very powerful thing, but we'd have to get into a whole conversation about that. Maybe that's just a mental block.
You've seen people say that, or you're worried that people would say that.
It's not that I've seen people say that. It's that I suspect it would be like one of the roadblocks for them. Yeah. Is like, oh, so it's like Venmo, but it's just a different kind of money or something.
Yeah,
I think that's which is maybe a foolish concern to have.
I think it's a fair concern, but that's not my experience because I do this a lot. As I send people their first, I have employees that I send them their first Bitcoin to, and yeah, that's like usually not the question. I think they're just like, kind of like, oh, okay, that's different. I thought I had to do this mine. I mean, people think that they have to mine Bitcoin in order to get a transaction. Like, that's the most common thing. But they have these misconceptions in their head that I heard about this mining thing, so I'm supposed to plug into a computer that does it. I'm also supposed to cold store it, so I don't know what that means. And so they think they're supposed to all do all that just to get it sent to them. So I think in their mind, if it was as simple as Venmo, that would actually be pretty cool, because if there's another option. Now, that for us, that frustrates us because it dumbs it down. Like you said, there's all these other intricacies, but in their mind, Venmo is actually a pretty awesome solution for sending money. So if we can at least get it to the world to be as accepted as Venmo, that's stage one. I guess that's actually a perfect example of what I was talking about, of like teaching a white belt technique. Right? The black belt understands that it was permissionless. The black belt understands that you could have sent $1 billion at that same speed to anywhere in the world, right? Which you can't do with Venmo. The black belt understands that in that Venmo transaction, there's actually 5 parties involved. There's the originating bank, there's the payment rail, there's the receiving bank, there's Venmo, right? There's the end receiver. We understand there's like 5 parties involved. The white belt level understanding is like, oh, okay. Well, Bitcoin's pretty simple. I sent it from here to there. And that's why it feels icky, because I didn't get to explain Bitcoin perfectly. But if today they walk away thinking it's as easy as Venmo, but then tomorrow they hear from somebody else that this whole like digital scarcity thing and how, well, actually the 5,000 sats that I have in my wallet, like that's a certain percentage of all the money out there. And it's not getting diluted. Like that stuff starts to click over time. And I think that's where, like, when we talk to our friends and family, we want to go in harder. But we just got to like learn to back off. Like, okay, they say it's like Venmo and I want to go harder, but I just leave it there today. Let it feel a little icky for me, because now they're one step closer. The other thing I do is I really try to make it showy when I send them that. I want to try and make it feel like it's not Venmo too. So I'll say stuff like, did you see that? Like, everybody told you that when you sent Bitcoin, by the time you received it, you couldn't pay for coffee because it would be cold by the time you got it. Well, look how fast I sent it to you. And by the way, if you were on the other side of the planet, it would have came just as fast. And we did it without anybody else giving us permission to send that money. And that's so much better than your Venmos or your PayPals, because there are middlemen. I mean, if you want to go that one step further, you can. But I try to make a little flash and pomp about it, but not overdo it. More just to make it exciting. I'm pretty comfortable with walking away feeling a little icky that I didn't get to perfectly explain it.
Yeah. So if I were to maybe summarize, meet people where they are and don't tell them to have fun staying poor.
Yeah, that's right.
That's so right. Okay, I've got to ask though, is there anyone in your life who either was or has been, is today a tough nut to crack on this, where they have like some objection that you've had a hard time overcoming, or maybe eventually you did, but took a longer time than you were anticipating?
Not that I can think of. And I think what's also cool though, is Bitcoiners, be willing to play the long game. If you've only been in Bitcoin since 2024, guess what? Your friend group, they don't give you a whole lot of equity in terms of like, oh, you called this a while ago. I have the benefit of, I've been telling my friends and family about Bitcoin since 2014. And so every time the market goes up, and they remember that Brian told them to get it at $250 or $500 or $1,000 or like they remember the first price that I told them about it. And so they remember the objections they had back then. So yes, there are people who in that cycle had objections that I couldn't crack, but it was always things that like I would answer it for one person and they'd be like, oh, that was a great answer. And then the other person was like, I would say the exact same answer, and they just say, oh, that doesn't make sense, right? And so it was more that person just kind of wanted to be pushing back against it. But because I've been calling it to my friends and family, like, you got to get it, you got like, dude, just pay attention to this. The price itself vindicates you over time. The adoption vindicates you over time. All of my friends who were conservatives that were just like, oh, this Bitcoin stuff's crazy. Well, now Trump's talking about it. Now, you know, there's a strategic reserve and all these things. The more adoption Bitcoin gets, it will vindicate you over time. And you'll recognize that those objections that people had, like the guy, you know, my friends that said, oh, well, how do you know, Bitcoin's not going to get usurped by another crypto? And like, here we are now. And they're like, they're kind of low key Bitcoin maxis. And I never answered that question effectively to them. Like I answered it what I think is effectively, but that didn't in the moment switch them over. It was the long arm of time that just kind of made them realize that they were in the wrong camp and they were starting to get on the wrong side of history. So yes, if you've only been telling your friends and family, not you, but I'm talking about the audience. If you've only been telling your friends and family for the last like 12 months, they're going to think you're new to this and that you're just on the hype train. But once you've been in it and you're looked at as like amongst your friends and family as the OG Bitcoin person, which might only be 2 years, right? Or 3 years in your friend circle and your social circle, that will also vindicate your point. And I think that that's almost like taking down every single wall. I can't think of somebody. I mean, I go to a pretty big church. I'm on the finance team of my church. I was on the board of my church before. I can't think of one person that is like still in the camp of, I don't hold any Bitcoin. I mean, I think they've all acquiesced at least some. And whether I answered the question that knocked it out of the park for them or whether they were just like, well, I don't want to be the only one that's not on this gravy train. They've all come around. And it's not because I'm exceptional, but it's because I put myself out there and then Bitcoin does the rest of the work. I mean, that the biggest lift has been done by Bitcoin for making me effective at orange pilling people.
So if I were to append a bit to my summary of your view, also lower your time preference,
yeah,
and be patient, play the long game.
Play the long game.
I think that's fantastic. So let's talk about the Orange Pill app, what you're working on. You and Mateo doing some awesome stuff, and the rest of the team. I know you've got a good group. What exactly, in your view, is the long-term vision of the Orange Pill app? And the reason I ask, this was a follow-up question I had, because I imagine a day where we've got something resembling hyper-Bitcoinization, and there isn't like this quote-unquote community of Bitcoiners. I know some people hate that term, but what do you anticipate the future of the Orange Pill app looking like? And then if you want, take a step back and tell people who maybe aren't familiar, you know, a bit about it.
Yeah, that's a great question. We literally just had, right before I got on this, I was wrapping. I by the way, for all those who don't know, Michael was very flexible and allowed us to move this interview back about 30 minutes because we were doing some like deep discussion for Orange Pill app this morning as far as like some of these issues specifically. For those who don't know, Orange Pill app is a social network for Bitcoiners. Now, I specifically say social network. We're not social media. Our goal isn't to get you to like log in like X and to just to scroll and look through content. There's really not much content in Orange Pill app. The content in Orange Pill app are other Bitcoiners. We want you to go in, either find a Bitcoin event that you're going to go to in real life or find another in real life Bitcoiner that's in your neighborhood. Most Bitcoiners don't know any Bitcoiners who live near them. That's the problem we're trying to solve for. We're trying to help Bitcoiners either participate in the local Bitcoin economy or to just engage with other Bitcoin meetups that they didn't recognize were there. I have two new guys in my city that are Bitcoiners that I didn't even know. These guys are within like a few miles of me. We've grabbed coffee. We've hung out. I've probably met in my city over the last couple of years, probably an extra like 15, 16 guys that are real Bitcoiners that are just regular dudes. Some of them come to my businesses now. I go and you know, there's, you know, some of them are like, one's a plumber, one cuts hair. Like, they're guys that I actually have economic ties to and economic connections with now, just because I met them in real life. The power of a handshake and looking somebody in the eye in real life is kind of something a little extra that we just don't get online. I think online connections are important, but Orange Pill app is specifically focusing on in real life connections. Now, if you think about the future of where things are going, I think that's a really good question is, yeah, when Bitcoin is the money of the world, are we going to have Bitcoin meetups? I don't think we really have internet meetups anymore, right? There was a time when you would have an internet meetup. People would sit around and talk about, I don't know, building websites and stuff like that. You might have business conferences kind of like that, but I think that the way of the Bitcoin conference might go away at some point. Specifically, Bitcoin branded businesses might go away because something like the Bitcoin Way, which will, something like that will always exist. It will just be kind of more like considered finance, right? Like this would be like the larger financial picture would be something that the Bitcoin, you might even have the same name. That might be like the timestamp on how long, you know, that's like that name that makes you sound really old school by that point, is that like, you're still called a Bitcoin company because that's, man, we just talk about Bitcoin as like the world's money. But yeah, all the Bitcoin companies will have to have a more universal appeal, because I think everybody will be a Bitcoiner to some degree. And what we're trying to solve for in the long term is what I just said that we're solving for in the short term, is in real life connections. 2 years from now, 3 years from now, the internet is going to be not unusable. It's going to actually be very useful, because it's going to give you the information you need. You know, you'll be able to get in, get the news you want. But most of us, it's going to be like plugging into the matrix. We're going to be inundated with AI, generated content. It's not going to be authentic. It's not going to be genuine. It's just going to be, there's going to be so much content. Like any teenage kid is going to be able to produce a Marvel level movie from his basement. And so when everything is produced at that kind of level, it's almost like when everything is exceptional, nothing's exceptional. And so internet content will probably be less appealing to most of us. There's going to be people that plug in and that's what they want in life, but there's going to be so many people that want to unplug. And I think the future is offline. I really do. We're all going to need the internet for finding a place to eat or doing all the things that we do on the internet, maybe getting a little bit of our information from it. But outside of that, I think people are going to gravitate more to offline. I mean, you think about something, this happens in every generation as technology gets better. Back in the day, if you went 200 years ago or 300 years ago, and you went up to a farmer and you took him in a time machine to 2025, and you took him to a gym and you walked him around, he would be absolutely confused as to why people are lifting heavy weights for fun. He's used to lifting bales of hay, and he's used to lifting sandbags and all these heavy things because he needs to do it for his job. And now we've taken lifting heavy things and it's like a pastime for us. That's because technology has gotten so good. It's made our lives so cushy that we have a desire to go back. Our bodies are, we crave this idea or this concept of doing difficult things. It used to be our work, and now we've got to make our fun things difficult in order to like satiate that human desire. And so, yeah, as things get more synthetic and as things get more digital, I believe, and Mateo believes, in the Orange Pill app, we believe that the world's only going to want in real life connections even more. I mean, this is echoed by Sam Altman. This is echoed by most of the AI people, is that the future is offline. And so I believe that we can use online tools to help people to basically be a supplement so that people can go offline and live real experiences. I mean, all the best experiences, all the best moments of your life were in real life. I know that's true for me. I mean, the day I got married, the first time I was, you know, the first time I, when my wife gave birth and I got to see my children for the first time, when I go and I hang out with a friend and have a good conversation, I mean, like all those things in real life, those are the best moments of my life. I can't point back to one thing where I was just like, you know what? I sat down and, doom scrolled on TikTok, and that was the greatest day of my life. That's just clearly not going to be, that's not going to compare to in real life experiences. So that's what we're solving for the future, is like, I think we can make everybody's life better by connecting them with other people in real life.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I can tell you, I've been fortunate to use OPA a few times to meet up with people. I don't have time at this stage of life to be going to a lot of in-person events locally, because I got young kids and plenty of other things going on. But I've met up for coffee a couple of times with some people, and it's hard to describe how much more engaging the conversation is. Like a complete stranger, and you sit down and it's like you've known them for years. You know, you're just kind of filling in like the details and the blanks on a couple of things, but you already know going into it, there's a pretty deep dive you can get into. I made a friend here in town just in the last year. It wasn't on OPA, but he's the only other Bitcoiner I know in like near me that I have any like close connection to. We went to Las Vegas together, where you and I met, and we talked the entire 3-hour flight out there. And I told him, I was like, there are I can count on less than a hand how many people I could talk to for three straight hours and it would, you know, remain interesting. Right. So I think people need to get out there and use it. Yeah. Is that, in your view, so you mentioned one other thing that to me seems like an incredibly positive externality of something like OPA, and that is building the circular economy, because I think that is that's how Bitcoin ultimately very fundamentally wins. I think if it remains digital gold, that's always store of value. I don't think it dies, but I think it just, you know, we all get, you know, what's the quote? Like we're all wealthy and depressed or something. Yeah. I think we need it to be used as currency as well. Is that something you're seeing a lot of, is these connections are made on OPA that people are finding, oh, this is a farmer who can sell me, you know, my beef. And this is someone who could cut my, you know, to your point, could cut my hair, and a plumber. Is that like, are those the connections that you're seeing being made every day?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, I think that when Mateo founded it, this idea, it was really, he was originally solving for the problem of most Bitcoiners don't have other Bitcoin friends in real life. But yes, this was a massive unintended consequence of the app. And it's like, you think about it for a few minutes, you're like, oh yeah, that actually makes sense that it would have gone in that direction. But I think that's maybe the most profound thing that we can do for Bitcoin, is when you sit Bitcoiners down and you bring them in person, they tend to, what do they talk about? They talk about Bitcoin. And then all of a sudden the idea that, and then they talk about what they do, right? Like, so as a Bitcoiner, when you sat down with a Bitcoiner, or when you sat down, you know, when you're on the plane ride with your friend, somebody is new, you sat down, talked to them for 3 hours. What are the things you talk about? You talk about Bitcoin because you're starting out on relationship second base, right? You have all these like shared values. But then we naturally, with anybody we talk to, we say, oh, well, what do you do for a living, right? Those two conversations lend so well to a Bitcoin circular economy, because all of a sudden, I know you're into Bitcoin. And now I just found out that you cut hair. And now you just found out that I have a wellness business, and that I sell books, and you know, all that type of stuff. And so now we're thinking about like, oh, well, you know, I would like to buy one of your books. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? I'm actually like, I need to get a haircut. All of a sudden, it just becomes part of the conversation. People are always trying to network in terms of business. And with Bitcoin, it's kind of like the cheat code. I think it's Peter McCormick who titled it the Bitcoin cheat code. And if for anybody that doesn't know what that term means, what he's referring to is, and he's talking about with his soccer team, is that you get people that wouldn't normally be customers of yours, or in his case, fans of his soccer team, unless you were that Bitcoin soccer team, or unless you were that Bitcoin barber. So for example, my barber, I travel 30 miles to go to my barber. Originally I have two barbers. I have one that's really close now, but I have the first barber that was a Bitcoiner that I ever went to, I would travel 30 miles to get to him. And that's in Southern California. That's like a 90 minute drive in Southern California, just because I wanted to spend Bitcoin on haircuts. And so think about that. I passed by hundreds of barbers on the way to get to this barber, and he got a customer from 30 miles away. Well, what's the typical radius of a barber's scope of customers? It's typically a 5 mile radius. He's going to get people from 5 miles around him. Well, Bitcoin enables him to get Bitcoiners from up to 30 miles away, because it's not just that I want a haircut. I want to be able to spend my Bitcoin, because I believe that that's an investment in the circular economy. And guess what? The thing that I found, and this is what we're finding over and over again, is that because most people's objection is, screw you, I'm never spending my Bitcoin. I'm going to hodl my Bitcoin. Like, how dare you tell me to spend my Bitcoin? Well, guess what? We've found this, and it's not just my own story. It's all the Bitcoiners that are on Orange Pill app that are spending Bitcoin in this parallel economy. If you spend Bitcoin in the parallel economy and you accept Bitcoin, guess what? You tend to stack more sats, because what happens in the fiat economy? At the end of every month, if you're doing it right, your income should be higher than your expenses. The same thing should be true in the Bitcoin economy. If you're spending less than you're earning, you're actually stacking more sats. So yes, if you want to stack more sats, spend some Bitcoin. I kid you not, that is absolutely what will happen. And so just start accepting Bitcoin, put yourself out there, change your X profile, or your primal profile, or your Orange Pill app profile, just to say that I'm the, you know, I'm a computer programmer who accepts Bitcoin, or I'm the Bitcoin computer programmer. All of a sudden, put yourself out there to the world. I accept Bitcoin. Somebody pays me fiat for what I do. Well, guess what? Somebody will pay you Bitcoin for what you do. And then as soon as you start getting jobs in Bitcoin and you turn around and spend your Bitcoin with other Bitcoiners, you're making economic connections that help you find other people who spend Bitcoin, which again, expands your pool of people who will turn around and spend Bitcoin with you. The analogy I always use is there's two types of people in the internet economy. You go back to the 1990s, there's two types of people that got rich from the internet economy. You had people that hodled domain names. They bought and sold or traded domain names. And so they would buy like business.com or pets.com. They would hold it for a couple of years and then sell it for millions of dollars. They got rich. That's awesome. But then there was guys that helped build the internet economy, like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos. They weren't just trading domain names or hodling domain names to try and get rich. They wanted to build the economic system of the internet. And guess what? They did. They built PayPal. They built Amazon. They built these incredibly smart and sophisticated internet economy companies. And now they didn't just make $15 million. They made like $300 billion. Like it's completely different if you're somebody that's just looking to buy and hold or buy and trade Bitcoin versus somebody who's participating in the Bitcoin economy. The people of tomorrow who are going to be the most prominent people in Bitcoin, I believe, are the Bitcoiners who are most active in the Bitcoin economy.
I love that, man. Let's leave it at that, because I think it's a good place to good pitch for OPA. And for anyone who's listening, seriously, one of my favorite things about your business model is there's a paywall. It's not expensive, but you are no longer the product. You get to actually use the product, which is completely antithetical in the social networking, social media space. So I love what you do. Alrighty, so I want to give you an opportunity here to choose your own adventure, because a lot of hot topics in Bitcoin today. So the few that I came up with: Knots versus Core, mining centralization, state of Bitcoin adoption, just broadly, like, you know, what your thoughts are, where we're at. And then, of course, everyone is always talking about price. We've had a lot of sideways price movement, very low volatility, which should excite some of the TradFi folks. But I would be curious if there's one in particular or something else that you'd like to discuss. And let's dive in there.
Yeah, I think state of Bitcoin adoption is the one to talk about. But I'm actually curious. I know this is like rude if I go on somebody's show and then I ask them the question. I was like legitimately curious as I was like kind of prepping through for today's show and what you guys do on your end of things. I mean, you guys are probably the most like one of the most important companies to ask, what do you think about the state of Bitcoin adoption? Because you guys are like boots on the ground in terms of this. What's your take on that?
I mean, overall, I would say we're busy. And so I don't know. It's hard to pinpoint. Is that because Bitcoin adoption is just flourishing, or hopefully at the very least, what we're seeing is more and more people they've heard not your keys, not your coins often enough that they are migrating into 100% self-custody, which is what we train on. The other reason we're busy, though, honestly, is an unfortunate reason, and that is one of our services is a Plan B residency in Panama, and we have lots of folks in Australia, Canada, the UK in particular, who are, you know, looking at the headlines, what's coming down the pipeline for them in those countries and in those jurisdictions, and they're saying, I have to either get out now or have a really readily available way to get out when the time comes. So my general sense is I think Bitcoin adoption is growing. And we were talking about like the conference numbers, you know, offline, before, if you just look at that sort of thing, if we look at the schedule that our team has, I mean, we're swamped. I think it's growing. I think, what is unclear to me at this point, not to go on like a rant that probably my listeners have heard at times before, is the newer class, like the most recent classes of Bitcoin adopters, what is their perception of what it means to be a Bitcoiner? Because like we talked about in Vegas, treasury companies, stable coins, Bitcoin lending, like it's a lot of like TradFi interwoven products being marketed. And my concern that I have is, are fewer people buying spot Bitcoin? And maybe that's part of the price action too. And more people are buying Strategy or something that they think is what it means to be a Bitcoiner, because that's what they're seeing and flooded with at conferences and on social media and that sort of thing. So that was kind of a long-winded answer. I don't know if I directly addressed, like a particular trend that I see, but it's just some general observations, I would say.
I mean, it's almost like it is like a profound thing that you're saying, though, is that just grinding upward growth feels normal. You're like, yeah, we're slammed, and we're like, people are moving and using Bitcoin to escape tyranny. And it's like, yeah, that's just like another day at the office. I mean, it's pretty like, yeah. Bitcoin's winning. I mean, that's rad. I mean, that's really cool to hear.
That's a good way of framing it. I think people are waking up, whether they can pinpoint the problem of fiat and back into that as the reason they need to flee into Bitcoin or into a new jurisdiction. I don't know. It's hard to say at this point, but people are waking up to there's a problem and I need a fix. And I think many are going to land on Bitcoin as the obvious solution.
Well, and I wonder if we've ever seen an economic migration like this before. Cause you think about, in the US, we talk about borders and immigration and illegal immigration and stuff like that. And typically people who are fleeing for asylum purposes are the poorest and the most vulnerable amongst us, right? They might be bringing over work skills or workforce, labor and stuff like that, but they're not bringing over wealth. They're not bringing over property and assets. But if you're getting wealthy Australians that are fleeing and going to El Salvador for asylum, it means that you're transplanting people that have buying power and capital that are being, so it's not just capital that's going into a country, it's people who can manage capital effectively moving into a country. This might be the most unique type of economic migration that we've ever seen. I imagine there's going to be history books written on it about this unique time in history about when rich people fled. Maybe that should be the title of a book, When Rich People Fled, because I don't think that that's ever happened before. We have stories of for sure from World War II, where people would gather